Hello and welcome to the Explanation Podcast, the show where we are accidentally timely. My name is Ian Stevens. I'm a YouTuber. I run a YouTube channel called The Lucretia Report and my website, lucretiareport.com, where I write articles and I make videos and all of that stuff. And you can follow me on Twitter and all that. The things are linked in the description.
And I am Silvia Salazar, founder of Tono Latino, also a political activist, kind of by accident. You can follow me at tonolatino.com.
And today we're going to be talking about the bilateral relationship between the United States and Canada. And I say that this was accidentally timely because I did not realize this, but Thursday, the week that this episode comes out, is Canada Day.
Oh!
So that's quite convenient. But we didn't plan this episode around this, so this is actually one of the ones that I wanted to do this topic because I wanted to get this guest on, because I'm very excited to talk to our guest later. We're going to have JJ McCullough on, and I think he's a very smart and interesting person that I think we had a great time talking to, so...
I agree.
Yeah. So you can follow the show on Instagram at The Explanation Pod, on Twitter at @Explanation_Pod, and on Facebook at The Explanation Podcast.
We want to hear from you, so feel free to contact us at info@TheExplanationPod.com.
And be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Leave a rating and a review if you're on a platform that allows for that, and share it with a friend, family member, coworker, all that good stuff.
Okay, Ian, tell me about Canada.
So, Sylvia, about 2 years ago at the NATO summit, which you'll remember Joe Biden just went to this year's NATO summit just a few weeks ago in Brussels. About 2 years ago was when that video you probably remember came out, where it had several world leaders laughing at Donald Trump and making fun of him. The ringleader of which was Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. And in response to that, Donald Trump called him two-faced. After the assault against protesters on Lafayette Square, Trudeau was asked to comment on that, and he was silent for a full 22 seconds before saying anything. And it was a pretty awkward 22 seconds, which is a while to sit there and watch in silence.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We do have Donald Trump now calling for military action against protesters. We saw protesters tear gas yesterday to make way for a presidential photo op. I'd like to ask you what you think about that. And if you don't want to comment, what message do you think you're sending?
We all watch in horror and consternation what's going on in the United States.
After the January 6th attack on the Capitol, Trudeau placed blame squarely on Donald Trump, blaming Donald Trump and other politicians in the U.S., quote unquote.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters, incited by the current president and other politicians.
I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump had a contentious relationship with a lot of world leaders, and a famously contentious relationship with Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, in particular. There's a lot of hope that the Biden administration will reverse that, and has been. In February, Trudeau said that it's great to see America re-engage under Biden. 2 weeks ago, Trudeau said that NATO was now more united than ever. And in a meeting with Trudeau in February, Joe Biden said that the United States has no greater friend than Canada. There's no word on how salty the British were about him saying that. So, the purpose of this show today, I think, is two things. First, we want to look at whether or not things have substantively changed under the Biden administration, if this is just a personal friendship, or if the U.S.-Canada relationship is really different. And also, Canada is one of those countries that we don't hear that much about. I've talked to JJ, who we're going to talk to later in the past before, about how even for Canadians, it's sometimes hard to learn about Canadian politics. And a lot of Canadians actually know more about American politics than Canadian politics, because it's just, there's not as much information out there. And I feel like Americans especially don't have a great understanding of the complexity and the nuance of Canada's government and politics. So I want to try to educate on that a little bit, because Canada is perhaps our most important partner in the world. They're our number one export market. They make up almost 20% of our exports. They're our number three import origin, following China and Mexico, making up about 13.2% of all the stuff imported into the United States. Every year, almost, well, every year before COVID, because obviously that's gonna mess things up. Every year, almost 15 million Americans visit Canada, and over 20 million Canadians visit the United States. And that's alongside all of the political partnerships and things like the United Nations, NATO, the G7, where Canada and the United States are almost always aligned. Just the economic links between our countries alone makes it extremely important to maintain the best relationship with Canada that we possibly can. So I want to start with a brief explanation of the Canadian government, how it works, because I think that a lot of people don't really have, you know, even the slightest idea how it works. And basically, it's almost exactly the same as the British government. I don't know if Canadians would like me saying that, but if you're familiar with the British government, you're probably pretty familiar with how this one works. So they are a part of the Commonwealth realm. So Queen Elizabeth is the head of state in Canada, represented in Canada by the Governor General, who is the representative of the Queen in Canada. He is basically a figurehead appointed by the Queen. And essentially, all of the things that the Queen does in Great Britain, the Governor General does in Canada. The real power is in the Parliament and the Prime Minister. Their House of Commons, like the United Kingdom, elects a Prime Minister from within them. They don't have any one vote each year. Like, we vote for a president every 4 years. Canadians, unless you're living in that Prime Minister's constituency, you don't vote for the Prime Minister. You vote for your Member of Parliament. And then the leader of the party that gets the most votes becomes the Prime Minister. For example, Justin Trudeau is the leader of the Liberal Party in Canada, which has the majority of the Canadian House of Commons. But only the people who are living in Papineau, which is a small constituency in downtown Montreal, only they actually get to vote for Justin Trudeau, because they're the only people he is directly representing as a member of the parliament.
And because he was the leader of that party, that's why he became prime minister. Yes?
Exactly. It's very similar. A lot of people were hearing recently in Israel when they were having the elections. It's a similar system to that, where Benjamin Netanyahu is the leader of the Likud party and Naftali Bennett is the leader of the Yamina party. And well, I mean, the Yamina doesn't have a majority in the Knesset, but that's a little weird. But the leader of the coalition that is in charge of the government right now, the leader, usually the leader of the largest party in parliament, gets to be the prime minister. In theory, it could not be the leader of the largest party. If you had like a coalition of smaller parties, you could get someone who's not the leader of the largest party being prime minister. But whatever coalition controls a majority of parliament, they do often look at it in terms of the prime minister, and the British do the same thing. People will talk about electing Justin Trudeau in this election, or electing Boris Johnson in Great Britain, or Ken Starmer, is that the name of the Labour Party leader in Britain? I can't remember. It's not Corbyn anymore. But they'll talk about it in those contexts, because they know that essentially by voting for the Liberal Party in Canada, you're voting for Justin Trudeau to be the prime minister, because if the Liberal Party gets the majority of seats, he will become the prime minister. And then they also have a Senate, which functions basically like the House of Lords in the United Kingdom. They are appointed by the Governor General on the advice and consent of the Prime Minister. So basically, the Prime Minister tells them who to appoint to the Senate. And they do have a veto on laws, but it is very rarely used, because it is an extremely archaic and undemocratic institution. And much like the House of Lords in the United Kingdom, it's very much kind of just a formality at this point, just like the Governor General or the Queen. Very ceremonial, very much of a figurehead.
Are there any kind of term limits, or is it similar to Israel that if you are the leader of the majority party, you get to stay as prime minister?
There are no term limits. As long as you're leading the governing coalition, you get to be prime minister. And as Netanyahu did in the past in Israel, you can stop being prime minister and then become prime minister again if your party comes back into power. Winston Churchill did that too in Great Britain. But the party can always change leaders. The members of that party get to choose who the leader for that party is, and if the party loses confidence, usually if they lose confidence in your ability to win elections and bring that party into power, they will change leaders, and they can even do that in the middle of a term between elections. There have been instances in the past where there have been, for instance, a vote of no confidence in the parliament or some other leadership change that has caused a prime minister in Canada to leave their term early. In fact, the shortest term for a prime minister, which was a while ago, was only 69 days as prime minister.
Wow.
And even as recently as the 90s, Prime Minister Kim Campbell was only prime minister for a few months in 1993. So you could potentially be prime minister for a very long time or a very short time. It's very different from the U.S. electoral system, but I think almost identical to the British one.
How many major parties are we talking about here?
They're the two biggest parties, which are the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party. The Liberal Party being the party that Justin Trudeau is in charge of right now and which has the most seats right now. It's kind of a center-left to centrist party, and the Conservative Party is kind of a center-right party. They don't really have a far-right party, a major far-right party in Canada. Of course, there are small parties that don't have any seats in Parliament right now, but they do have several other left-wing parties. They have the Bloc Québécois, which is a Quebecois Nationalist Party in Quebec, and it's social democratic economically, so that would be kind of like Bernie Sanders, AOC in America, kind of, they would be social democrats, but it's very nationalist socially. They have the New Democratic Party, or NPD, which is just a straight up social democratic party, and the Green Party is the smallest party in Parliament with only two seats, similar to the Green Party in the United States or in Great Britain. And of course, for any Canadian government, maintaining the relationship with the United States is of the utmost priority, because as much as Canada is important to the United States, the United States is even more important to Canada. I quoted earlier the trade numbers of the United States' exports and the United States' imports, but Canada's exports, 73% of them go to the United States, and 57% of Canada's imports come from the United States. And that 20.7 million Canadians every year that travel to the United States, if each of those 20.72 people were all individual people, which I know is not the case, there are a lot of people that go multiple times in a year, that would be 55% of the population of Canada visiting the United States every year.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when you mentioned those numbers originally, and you said 20 million Canadians visit the U.S. Immediately, I was like, wait, that's more than half the population of the country. But obviously, like you said, some people enter multiple times, but still, that's quite significant.
It's a huge portion of the population, and a lot of Canadian businesses. Any business that gets above a certain size in Canada starts centering itself around the American market. And a lot of Canadian nationalists hate that. But every big company in Canada that's not like the CBC or, you know, or something like that is eventually going to realize that all the money is in America, and they're going to start tailoring themselves to satisfy Americans. So I want to go through what I think are the most important issues in the U.S.-Canada relationship right now. And those are going to be climate change, Russia, trade slash the border, I'm putting those together into one, and waters or territorial disputes. Ooh. Which there's one in particular. There are several of those, but one in particular is the one that actually matters right now. So let's start with climate change. The current U.S. and Canadian leaders, Joe Biden and Justin Trudeau, have both claimed to place combating climate change as a very high priority. But just as Joe Biden has been criticized by a lot on the left for not putting sufficient action behind those words, Justin Trudeau has also been criticized. In fact, he's been called out for climate hypocrisy, most notably by Bill McKibben, who wrote a very popular op-ed in The Guardian. Canada has committed to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, and that's very doable, and they're on the way there, largely because almost 60% of their power comes from hydroelectric, so only about 18% of their power comes from fossil fuels and about 15% from nuclear, which people have mixed opinions on that, but they have a much smaller percentage of their power grid to decarbonize than the United States, for instance, does. Canada's real contribution to climate change right now, though, does not come from their own emissions. It comes from the emissions that they are enabling other countries to create. And the way that they're doing that is largely through extraction of tar sands in places like Alberta. Tar sands are a type of oil that is seeping up through the ground into kind of a sandy, mushy, gross thing that you can mine, basically. You don't really have to drill for it as much like oil that's underground. You can just kind of mine for it more like you would for ore. And that is a major export of Canada. More than one-fifth of Canada's exports are some kind of petroleum product. And the problem with that is that, first of all, it's making oil much more readily available and cheaper, which is discouraging people and companies and countries from converting to renewable sources. And second of all, because tar sands produce 3 times as much carbon emissions as regular oil like you would drill in Texas or in Saudi Arabia does. And so the fact that Canada is exporting such large amounts of tar sands onto the international market, because very much of it is not even going to Canada or the United States, it's getting exported worldwide, is making it both easier for countries to continue using fossil fuels, and it's making sure that the fossil fuels they are using are kind of the worst ones they could be using. And Justin Trudeau, who, like I said, has been saying that he wants to make climate very important, people have been pushing for him not to allow nearly as much mining for tar sands in Canada and Alberta especially, and he has been very resistant to that. He's allowed for mining to continue basically uninterrupted, and this actually led to the first kind of clash between Justin Trudeau and Joe Biden after Joe Biden became the president. And that's because you'll remember that right at the beginning of Joe Biden's presidency, he canceled the Keystone XL pipeline, which was supposed to bring tar sands from Alberta down to connect to an existing pipeline in Nebraska and eventually bring them to Port Arthur in Houston, Texas for export. Although they were very diplomatic publicly, Trudeau said that he was disappointed with the decision of Biden to revoke the permit for that pipeline. Reportedly, he was lobbying pretty hard for Biden not to revoke it in the first place. And then in their first meeting in February, he apparently tried to convince Biden to change his mind on that to no avail.
Who are the people in Canada behind this? Because like you said, on one side, Trudeau is saying, oh, we need to care for the planet, blah, blah, blah. But on the other side, he's lobbying Biden not to cancel the XL pipeline and doing something completely opposite to his stance on climate change. So what are the powers behind Trudeau right now allowing or incentivizing him not to cancel the mining of this tar in Alberta, for example?
I think it's an economic concern. Obviously, the business community in Canada pushes hard for this mining to continue. The oil companies themselves, the transport companies, the pipeline companies, but also the equivalents of like the Chamber of Commerce and other business interest groups. But I think it's largely just a concern about the economy, because the tar sands do employ a lot of people in Canada. And like I said, almost 20% of Canadian exports are coming from this, especially in Saskatchewan and especially Alberta. This is the biggest industry. And so it would be very unpopular amongst a lot of people to scale this down in any way. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, I think, where if he does scale this down, that's going to make him very unpopular amongst one segment of the population. And if he does not, it's going to make him very unpopular amongst another segment of the population. Personally, I think that he's probably making the wrong political calculation. And the reason I say that is because the political forces and the people who are the areas that are supported by this industry are not the areas that vote for Justin Trudeau. Saskatchewan and Alberta, which are the two provinces where this largely happens the most, his party, the Liberal Party, has zero seats in those provinces. They don't have one member of parliament from those provinces. Now, a lot of people would say that, oh, well, you know, that's kind of elitist, you know, coastal elite. You don't want to marginalize people in the middle of the country and say, oh, like, their interests don't matter because they don't vote for this party. But at the end of the day, I think it's obvious that the long-term interests of everyone, including people in Alberta and Saskatchewan, are served by not exploiting tar sands. So that's the first point of contention between Joe Biden and Justin Trudeau. And it could potentially continue from there, because there are other pipelines that people want to build and are building from Canada down to the United States and ports in the United States. And a lot of those are going to have very significant pushback in Canada, but also in the United States. And Joe Biden's going to be under a lot of pressure not to roll over on these pipelines all the time. And I feel like the ones that don't get a lot of press, he'll probably be able to slip those under the radar. But if there's another one that gets as much attention like the Keystone XL pipeline, it's going to be very politically difficult for Joe Biden to let that by. So the second issue I want to move on to is trade slash the border. Donald Trump entered into kind of a low-scale trade war with Canada while he was president, placing tariffs on Canada, and then Canada placed tariffs back on the United States. For instance, the U.S. placed tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum for a while, and Canada placed tariffs on a wide range of American products, including whiskey and paper for a while, but also a bunch of other stuff. The genesis of this small-scale trade war that Donald Trump initiated, and of a lot of trade disputes between the United States and Canada historically, has been that Canada has a very protectionist approach to trade. And what I mean by that is that they put in place a lot of artificial measures to make sure that Canadian products are more competitive than other products, whether that's tariffs or subsidies or quotas or things like that. To give an example, you're only allowed to import a certain amount of dairy into Canada. Like, the entire country is only allowed to import a certain amount of dairy every year. And once they pass that quota, all subsequent dairy has a massive tariff, something like 240%, which makes it essentially not economically viable to import dairy past that quota into Canada. Add to that, Canadian dairy farmers are very heavily subsidized, and the United States and a lot of other countries view that as unfair. The United States would say that that makes it hard for American companies to compete, and that Canadian dairy makers don't have the same restrictions exporting to the United States, so it's not fair that Canada has those kinds of policies that make it hard for American companies. And that's been a long-standing complaint of the United States. Most of the tariffs that Donald Trump and Justin Trudeau placed during his presidency have been lifted now. One of the ones that continues to be a point of contention is the U.S. tariff on softwood lumber, which the United States has in place because they claim that Canadian subsidies to the lumber industry, like I said, make it unfair, make it hard for American companies to compete with Canadian companies. And so, in order to balance that out, the U.S. has placed a tariff on Canadian softwood lumber coming into the United States so that American companies can compete more. This is, in fact, such an issue to Canada that this is another one of the issues that Trudeau raised with Biden in that first meeting I mentioned in February, the one where he tried to convince Biden to change his mind about the Keystone XL pipeline. He also tried to get Biden to lift this tariff. The United States has a similar beef, though, with Canadian restrictions on American products. One of the big ones is culture and media. People don't often realize, but one of America's biggest exports is media, is movies, music, entertainment, things like that. And Canada is very protectionist about that, too. The reason they are is because there was a time in the past where the American market, being so much larger than Canada, dominated Canadian media. Canadian TV stations were broadcasting American shows and American TV stations were broadcasting into Canada. And the same thing had happened with radio a few decades before that. And so first they placed these restrictions on radio in Canada and then later on TV in Canada and movies and such. And they're essentially restrictions that require that Canadian broadcasters air a minimum percentage of what's quote unquote Canadian content so that they can make sure that they're not excluding Canadian producers, Canadian directors, Canadian actors, Canadian production houses, Canadian media. One of the problems is that it's a little weird what they consider to be Canadian content and what they don't consider to be Canadian enough. It's a little bit arbitrary. An example is the movie Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which was filmed in Toronto. It starred Michael Cera, who is from Canada. It was first released at the Fantasia Film Festival in Montreal, Canada, and it's based on a book written by a Canadian and set in Canada. That movie, though, was not deemed to be Canadian. That was not considered a Canadian movie.
That's very Canadian.
You would think, but it had a British director and distributed by Universal Pictures. So an American distributor and a British director. But even though it's set in Toronto, starring a Canadian, released in Montreal and based on a Canadian book, that's not Canadian enough. So it's a little bit weird what they deem to be a Canadian film and what they don't deem to be a Canadian film. Same with TV shows. And they're even working on a bill which would expand these same restrictions to internet media like YouTube. And it's not totally clear how that would work yet, but there's some, you know, the nationalist branch of people in Canada are very excited about any kind of restrictions like that that make it harder for American things to outshadow Canadian things, because that really is a problem, that the American market's so big that Canada often gets overshadowed even in Canada. But a lot of people are viewing that as something that's going to be limiting to what Canadians are able to enjoy and what they're able to choose to enjoy. And the United States, being the entertainment and production and content creation powerhouse that we are, would like to have more of our movies and TV shows and music and all of that stuff bought and viewed in Canada. So we would like to see some of those restrictions lifted. And perhaps there will be some kind of agreement where, for instance, the softwood lumber restrictions are lifted and then some cultural restrictions are dialed back. But I could see there being in this administration some kind of reciprocal lifting of sanctions, but I could just as easily see it continuing the path it is, I think. Complementary to that is the issue of the border, because the border was closed for COVID-19, of course, and is still closed as of recording. I mean, I have to put that disclaimer in there because I guess they could open it up any day now. But a lot of people are calling for that border to be reopened, because we talked earlier about just how many Canadians and Americans would usually cross that border in a normal year. And cases are now down to their lowest point in the United States since March and in Canada since September. So we're really getting close to a point where it doesn't make any sense for that border to be open. Canada and the U.S. have respectively now 87 and 95 vaccine doses per 100 population. These numbers are based on yesterday at time of recording, so that would be June 22nd is the day that these numbers are coming from. And so a lot of people are now saying that it doesn't make any sense to continue to have the border closed, especially when Canada's cases are now like below 1,000 per day. It's like in the hundreds per day. And so that's another issue that Trudeau and Biden have been trying to work on, that Trudeau is raised with Biden and vice versa, and they've been trying to sort out. And the last point of contention I want to go over is with waters and territorial disputes. And I want to say first that I'm going through a lot of the contentious relationships between the United States and Canada. I don't want to make it sound like America and Canada have a bad relationship. We definitely don't. In fact, we have one of the closest relationships of two countries in the world. But I feel like, you know, generally speaking, that America and Canada work together on most things. I want to add a little bit of nuance to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, the rest is not a honeymoon, but it's all in good terms. And these are the really important things where the countries need to figure stuff out.
And so the last contentious spot, we're going to talk about one more area of cooperation after this, but the last contentious spot I want to get to is waters and territorial disputes. I think a lot of people would be surprised, actually, to discover that the United States and Canada have 5 territorial disputes. Whoa. And they're all over water. One of them is a little bit of land and an island, but they're all over... It's not like America says the border is here and Canada says the border is here. It's all maritime borders, so it's not as big a deal as, for instance, Kashmir or, you know, the Donbass or Crimea. But it is still something to consider, especially the last one that I'm going to talk about. The last one I'm going to talk about is the big one. So let's go through the first 4 real quick. We've got Machias Seal Island, which is a little rock with a lighthouse on it off the coast of Maine. But Canada says that they own this island, America says that they own this island. And the reason that that matters is because of fishing rights. Right now, there's kind of a gray zone where fishers from both Nova Scotia and Maine are using the waters around this island. And it's actually getting to the point that lobster and crab and the other things that they fish for in that part of the world are getting overfished, because having the fishermen from both Maine and Nova Scotia is just kind of too much for the ecosystem. And so it would be nice if we could agree on something about that before that whole area around Machias Seal Island just runs out of lobster and fish and stuff. The second one is the Straits of Juan de Fuca, which is between British Columbia and Washington. And it's not actually about the border in the strait. It's about when it gets to the ocean outside the strait, the way that that border extends into the ocean for the 12 miles of territorial waters, the 12 miles of the contiguous zone, and then the 100 miles of the exclusive economic zone. The United States maintains that the equidistant border between the land of Canada and the United States is the right line to draw. Canada has a claim that gives them a little bit more water and therefore fishing rights, just like a lot of these are going to be about fishing rights. A little more water and a little bit more fishing rights because of some seabed geography that they say should extend their border to go around that canyon that's on the seafloor. The reason that that's a little bit weird from Canada is because that's the opposite of the argument that they're making over in Maine and Nova Scotia. So they kind of seem to be wanting to have their cake and eat it too. The United States is maintaining an equidistant border on both sides, but Canada is claiming an equidistant border in Maine where they do own Machias Seal Island, and the United States is claiming equidistant border where they own Machias Seal Island.
So they're changing their stance depending on which waters are convenient for them to fish in.
Exactly. In Maine, the equidistant border gives Canada more waters, and in Washington, the equidistant border gives America more waters. So Canada wants to go with the equidistant border in Maine and not go with the equidistant border in Washington.
How convenient.
And then 2 more just lines of control in water up in Alaska and the Yukon along the border with Canada there. The United States, once again, wants to maintain an equidistant border going out into the ocean. Canada drew a border where it's parallel to the land border between Alaska and the Yukon. And so that creates a little slice of disputed territory in the water there. And the reason that that's important to people is because there might be a lot of oil in that water. I particularly maybe wouldn't mind if we never figured that one out and no one starts drilling that oil. But yeah, that's maybe not what Joe Biden and Justin Trudeau and the State Department would be considering. And then the Dixon Entrance, which is between Alaska and the British Columbian archipelago of Haida Gwaii, which I may not be pronouncing that correctly. I think that it's an indigenous name. Essentially, there is an old treaty that was to set the boundary of Alaska, where there was a line drawn on that map called the AB line, which Canada is saying was the maritime border, and the United States is saying that that was just a line to show, like, land on this side belongs to the United States and land on that side belongs to Canada, and the United States still wants to maintain the equidistant border between Haida Gwaii and Alaska there. Largely because the AB line is right up on the land. It would give very little territory, like less than the standard 12 miles of territorial waters south of Alaska. But those are all kind of minor disputes that probably won't get into the news, probably won't be a big deal, may not even make it to the level of head of state discussions. Or I guess I shouldn't say head of state because Queen Elizabeth is the head of state of Canada, but you know, head of government discussions. The big one is the Northwest Passage. And what this is the way to sail from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean by going north of Canada. For a long time, that was impossible. But because of climate change, a lot of ice is melting up there, and there is a new sea route that's opening up, which has the potential to be very lucrative, because it would take a long time to go down around Cape Horn and the Strait of Magellan, and the waters there are pretty rough in addition to that. That's along the, you know, Argentina and Chile, along the southern edge of South America. And that's especially if you're going from, like, for instance, Europe to China, which are both in the northern hemisphere. And in the Panama Canal, which has been the traditional route, you can only fit ships that are so big in the Panama Canal. And modern container ships have largely maxed out the Panama Canal. They call them Panamax ships, in fact, because they're like, they're made to be exactly big enough to fit in the Panama Canal. You should see the pictures. There's like a foot of space on either side of the ship because they're trying to fit as much as they possibly can.
And we already, this year we saw what happens when you have a container ship that is too big for a body of water, when that, whatever it was called, the ever given
in the Suez,
the ever given stuck in the Suez Canal.
Suez, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Getting stuck in the Panama Canal would be very inconvenient. But if shippers were able to sail through the Northwest Passage, which is not quite economically viable yet, you still usually need an icebreaker. You can only do it in summer. But in a few years, it's going to be economically viable as more and more of the polar ice caps melt. If they could sail through that, they could sail much larger ships than they can fit through the Panama Canal, and it would make a ton of money. The dispute is not about the United States saying that they own the Northwest Passage. I think anyone would probably look at that and see that as ridiculous, since it goes almost completely just through Canada. The United States says that it is an international waterway. Which, what that is that would be things like the Strait of Gibraltar or the Malacca Straits, where this is a non-man-made waterway. It's not a canal, but it's a natural waterway that connects two large bodies of water. And under international law, international waterways are often not excludable. You can't take tolls on the Strait of Gibraltar. You can't exclude ships from the Strait of Gibraltar. They have to be maintained basically in international ownership. Even though there would still be territorial waters, the territorial waters would work differently in an international waterway. Canada rejects that, saying that the Northwest Passage is Canadian sovereign waters. And you can see the motivations there. Canada rejects it being an international waterway because they could potentially make a lot of money off of charging tolls to go through the Northwest Passage. The United States, and other countries too, but the United States are really leading the charge on it, wants it to be an international waterway because they don't want to pay those tolls. This is the only one of the territorial disputes that I think is actually an issue that could make it up to the highest levels of government. In fact, just last year, the U.S. State Department released a kind of incendiary statement flatly rejecting Canadian sovereignty over the Northwest Passage.
In other instances, for example, in the Panama Canal, the ships pay tolls.
Yes.
Obviously, the other countries don't want to do that, but I don't know, I'm kind of siding with Canada on this one.
So the Panama Canal is a little bit different because it's man-made. This would be more akin to something like, at least America's arguing that this would be more akin to something like the Strait of Gibraltar between Spain and Morocco. What Canada would compare this to would be, for instance, the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is what connects the Atlantic Ocean to the Great Lakes. And that is sovereign Canadian waters. But it does connect the Great Lakes to the Atlantic, so you could make the argument that, like, oh, ships have to go through this to get from Europe to Chicago. That would be what Canada would compare it to. The United States would compare it to something more like Gibraltar or Malacca. Does that make sense?
I still see them as their waters, but okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a valid viewpoint. A lot of people do. It would probably have to be solved through international arbitration in something like, in a place like The Hague, where they look at the existing international law and people that know a lot more about international law than me, international lawyers, I don't know if you call it international lawyers, but lawyers specializing in international law, would look at the treaties that have been signed and try to determine what is most fitting. That's probably how this would end up being resolved. And so those are what I think are the main points of contention that Joe Biden's going to have to deal with as president when it relates to Canada. He's going to have to deal with trade and whether we continue to tariff Canada, whether Canada continues to tariff us. He's going to have to deal with the border and whether that's going to get reopened. He's going to have to deal with the Northwest Passage, and he's going to have to cooperate with Canada on climate change and deal with their desire to export tar sands and Joe Biden's desire to not get bashed by the political left for not being hard enough on climate change. I do, though, want to look at an area of cooperation, which I think is very important right now. And that area of cooperation is Russia. Looking at the map, you may not at first think that Canada has all that much interest in combating Russia compared to like our European allies, for instance, compared to a place like Germany or Poland, which is on the border of Russia through the Kaliningrad Oblast, of course. But then when you turn the globe a little bit and you look up north, you realize that Canada is actually not all that far from Russia if you go over the Arctic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is becoming more and more of an issue for the same reason that the Northwest Passage is becoming more and more of an issue. Because ice is melting up there. And that is really changing a lot of things geopolitically. One of the things that it is changing is the claims. Up until the modern day, the center of the Arctic Ocean has usually been considered international waters, and the edges of it have belonged to the countries that are along the Arctic Circle. Russia gets part of it, Canada gets part of it, America gets part of it, Norway, Iceland, Denmark, through Greenland get part of it. But now that the ice is melting, all of those countries, not just Russia, not just Canada, all of them are really rushing to take claims over the waters in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. Ironically, largely because they can extract gas and oil from them, which the irony of ice melting so that you can drill gas and oil is...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it's lost on no one. But it creates a very dangerous situation, especially when Russia is militarizing the Arctic. In the last few years, Russia has built 475 new military bases in the Arctic Ocean, including 16 deepwater ports, missile launchers, radars, and air bases. And that has, understandably, made a lot of people in Canada and the United States and Denmark very nervous. Russia, of course, claims that these are peaceful and that they're for self-defense, which makes a certain amount of sense, because just like Canada is seeing the Northwest Passage open up to ships with the melting ice, Russia is seeing their own Northern Sea Route open up. They're calling it the Northern Sea Route, which similarly would cut the distance you would have to travel between Asia and Europe by going through Russian waters in the Arctic Ocean. So it makes sense that they would want to move more military assets there as these waters are getting a lot more valuable and they may want to defend them. But Russia's got a sort of a reputation, you might say, that you can see how this militarization is making the countries on the Arctic very nervous. Canada has been cooperating with the United States and basically doing kind of the same things the United States is to combat Russia. They've been selling weapons to Ukraine. In 2019, about $700,000 of weapons, mostly small arms, were exported from Canada to Ukraine. They've placed sanctions on Russia after Russia annexed the Crimea. Canadian exports to Russia were cut by about two-thirds because of sanctions, and they never really rebounded after that. And they've got sanctions on certain individuals and institutions. It's basically the same things America is doing. Like America, it doesn't really seem to be deterring Russia much. So alongside Germany, Britain, Poland, Ukraine, and our European allies, Canada is eager to cooperate with the United States and try to find a better way to deal with Russia and tame the Putin. A funny story I read when looking this up. After Joe Biden referred to Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, as a killer, Justin Trudeau was asked by a reporter if he agreed that Putin was a killer. And he kept asking him, and he said, I'm sure he's behind a bunch of terrible things, but was kind of dodging, like, didn't want to place the killer label on Putin. And I just thought that was a little bit amusing.
I liked how you said, tame the...
So those, I think, are the most important issues that are facing the United States-Canadian bilateral relationship at the moment. And if I were to give my take, granted, this is still early in the Biden administration, but if I were to give my take would be that not much has changed more than rhetoric so far in the relationship between the United States and Canada. But there's a lot of opportunity. And there are more places than I think the average person would realize for some substantive diplomatic action between these countries. Which of those areas do you think is the most important to be focusing on right now, Sylvia?
Ooh, that's a good question. They're already collaborating or cooperating with how to handle Russia, so I think that is definitely a huge priority because what Putin is doing is impacting a lot of different issues. I would have to side with the climate change situation because, I mean, we're all in this planet together and it's a issue that affects the entire human race, not just people from a certain country. And we need to deal with it whether we like it or not. And like you pointed out at the beginning, when you were discussing Justin Trudeau and how he is probably making a political mistake by quote unquote protecting the people of those provinces that mine the tar sands for a short-term gain versus the long-term situation, which is to save our planet. That's to me, that's number one. We need to figure out ways to not screw people over so that they give them a way to earn an income, but also not destroy the planet at the same time.
Yeah, you know, I think that that is the fundamental problem with that. Climate change is an issue that capitalism is not designed to handle because capitalism is centered around short-term profit. All of the incentive structures are to try to make money now and like next year. But even though in the long run, you could secure your company and your country better by planning for the 20 years down the road instead of the 1 year down the road, there's a culture and a set of structures that make it hard for people to do that kind of long-term planning when you have to make a profit this quarter and you have to see GDP go up this quarter to secure your political aspirations. And if profit goes down, then you as a CEO get fired. And if the GDP doesn't go up and all of these economic metrics don't go up every single year and every single quarter, then you as a politician get fired.
In the long term, though, I do see a lot of the younger generations like yours focus or pay more attention to these companies that have additional ways of generating positive impact in many different ways. So, for instance, there's a lot more B Corps. There's a lot more focus on farmers markets or even companies that are obviously generating profits. They're not nonprofits, but they donate a percentage of their profits to important causes, or they pay higher wages to people in faraway countries, things like that. That is something that I see more and more and more with younger generations that gives me a little bit of hope.
Well, Sylvia, are you ready to go talk to someone who knows a lot more about Canada from a lifetime of experience than we do?
Let's do it.
So today we're going to be talking to J.J. McCullough. J.J. McCullough is a Canadian political writer and columnist from Vancouver, British Columbia. He writes a column about Canada and their politics for the Washington Post, and he runs his YouTube channel under his name, J.J. McCullough, where he talks about culture, Canada, and politics and all kinds of things like that. It's also dabbling into like flags and other niche things that he's interested in. And I'm really excited to talk to him because I think that he, personally, I was not one of those people that understood Canada very well before I started watching his videos. And like I think a lot of people do in America, I kind of never considered that Canada is like a whole country that has its own complex politics and internal debates and issues. And like, I guess I had never considered the nuance and depth that Canada has, because you never hear about that in America. You always just hear, you know, like, oh, hockey and moose. But he's really educated me, and I think that you're really going to enjoy hearing from him.
Let's do it.
Thank you for joining us, JJ. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to jump right into the first thing I want to ask you is just about your general take of the Canadian-American relationship, because President Trump famously had a strained relationship with many of the Western world leaders, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was no exception to that. But now Joe Biden's the president, and right before the election, Politico ran a headline that said, "Can Joe Biden pick up where Trudeau Obama left off?" And in that they wrote, "The strained relationship between the US and Canada is creating an appetite for Joe Biden to rekindle the cross-border bromance between Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Barack Obama if he secures the White House." And I feel like that's a common sentiment in punditry around the relationship with Canada, as well as the UK, France, Germany, and the rest of our allies in general. So Biden's been president for a few months now, and he's met with Trudeau and the Canadian government virtually and in person at the G7 recently. And so have US-Canadian relations rebounded the way that people have predicted, or is there still a ways to go?
I mean, I do think that sometimes we can be a little bit too reductive when we sort of view cross-border relations strictly through the lens of kind of domestic partisan ideology. So, for example, like there was a lot of sort of hoopla about the Obama-Trudeau bromance, so-called, but I do kind of feel like that a lot of that was sort of more based on kind of a projection of the degree that we imagine these two leaders being sort of simpatico at a kind of personal or philosophical level, as opposed to because that this was some necessarily golden age of sort of cross-border cooperation or partnership. I mean, the overlap between Trudeau and Obama was relatively brief. I think it was barely a year, if that, versus, you know, Trudeau has spent most of his administration coexisting with President Trump. And for all of the, you know, supposed tension that existed there, and some of it was real, but I do think that particular cross-border relationship, or I should say that particular Trump relationship, was actually a bit less fraught than some of the other international relationships that Trump sort of weakened during his time in office. You know, it's worth remembering that we did actually renegotiate NAFTA during the Trump administration, the new agreement, the USM,
the US Mexico Canada agreement.
Yeah. NAFTA 2.0, whatever. That happened during the Trump years, and it was quite a fraught process from the Canadian side, although, you know, it was always very obvious that the reason why it was being done was primarily because Trump had some sort of fixation with Mexico and sort of wanted to appease his base by, you know, driving a tough bargain with them. Whereas from the Canadian sort of perspective, I think it was quite a bit, you know, it was fraught, but it was ultimately more of a non-event from the Trump administration side, because there was ultimately less that they wanted to get out of Canada. But, you know, the agreement was modernized, and although it was not as modernized in, it wasn't liberalized to the degree that someone like me, who is very pro sort of integration between our two countries, would have liked to see, you know, it was modernized, and that's not nothing. You know, it was the first substantial revisit of this cross-border economic relationship in, you know, close to 30 years. So that's a very substantial achievement. And in that sense, That's a metric that now the Biden administration will have to meet or exceed. If we are truly to sort of say that this new administration is going to herald a sort of new glory age that goes beyond just the idea that the two men like each other more in some sort of meaningful way. And we know that Trudeau and President Biden do like each other. There was a state, one of the last actual things that happened during the Obama years was that Joe Biden had a state visit to Ottawa and, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau feted him and all of this kind of thing. It was a big deal. So there can be no denial that that Trudeau likes Biden more than he likes Trump, that he's happy that he has a leader that he can sort of communicate in a somewhat less prickly and mercurial sort of way. But on the other hand, it's like, is there a clear agenda of what either leader really wants from the other in the way that, for better or for worse, Trump did have something very clear that he wanted out of this relationship? I think that there's, you know, there are reasons to suspect that when it comes to things like climate change and sort of being more simpatico on that front, that perhaps there's some reason for optimism. But as far as I know, there isn't yet a big sort of marquee ask from either leader to either side as of yet, which is not to say that there might not be, that, which is not to say that one might not develop as the Biden administration perhaps gets a little bit more comfortable.
Okay, I do want to make a distinction between the Canadian and American governments and the people, because I feel like a lot of times people try to equate the leader, specifically Justin Trudeau and Canada, and especially in countries like ours where there's a parliament and a congress that they have to answer to, these leaders can't single-handedly make all of the decisions on their own. So I'm wondering to what degree the attitudes of the Canadian people, Canadian voters, would align with the attitude of Justin Trudeau in regards to the U.S.-America relationship. Are the wishes of the voters aligned with what the government's interest is? And do you see the Canadian government representing what people want out of the U.S.-Canada relationship?
Well, this is. I mean, that's a very good point and question and observation, because that is one of, I think, the great struggles with relationships between Western democracies, right? Because generally speaking, you know, like in most Western countries, we're pretty well versed in American politics. We understand American politics through the lens of our own domestic politics. You know, it's like a left winger in Canada obviously sort of sympathizes with the Democrats more than the Republicans and vice versa. And so Justin Trudeau, as sort of head of a progressive government during the Trump years, was always under a lot of pressure from a base that basically didn't like Trump and, you know, didn't want to see Trump treated politely or respectfully or whatever. And so that was sort of a difficult position that Trudeau was sometimes in, because, you know, Trudeau, as much as he is the head of a progressive political party, is also head of the entire country, thus sort of has to behave in a diplomatic, sort of polite way and sort of get along well with a leader, despite the fact that he is not only unpopular with the base of his own political party and his own voters, but is, you know, broadly unpopular with the Canadian public as a whole. So this is another reason why I think that there is reason for optimism. You know, whenever both leaders in Canada and America are sort of in line with each other politically, ideologically, that is a moment in which it sort of is, you know, when the moment of opportunity is greatest, because the Canadian leader is sort of risking the least political capital to foster closer relations, right? Because it doesn't become seen as, you know, that Trudeau or whoever is selling out Canada to this evil, you know, right-wing government or whatever. It's seen as, you know, Trudeau partnering with a like-minded government in the U.S., right? I mean, it's always a challenge because, you know, as anybody who's consumed any of my work knows that I do believe very strongly that anti-Americanism is one of the defining characteristics of Canada and Canadian nationalism and Canadian national identity. And that, too, is also always a barrier that I think prevents the sort of thoughtful integration of shared continental interests that I think is in the mutual interests of both countries. And a good example of this right now is, you know, since COVID, quite early on in the COVID process, both countries agreed to, you know, basically tighten the border to the maximum extent. You know, there's very little free travel between the two countries except for, you know, what are deemed essential services. I think that certainly as both countries now have quite high rates of vaccination and, you know, states and provinces are opening, I do think that that is becoming a more that this, the strictness of the border and the limitations of travel is becoming a harder and harder thing to justify. But when you look at polls, you know, Americans are broadly in favor of opening the border. Canadians are broadly in favor of keeping it closed. And to me, part of that can only be explained by just a kind of knee-jerk anti-American sentiment that a lot of Canadians have, right? Where they just tend to err on the side of maximum suspicion of the U.S. And a sort of desire to, you know, to just not have more to do with the U.S. than is absolutely necessary. And I think that that becomes an obstacle to sort of rational policymaking as well, because you have a leader like Trudeau who, you know, again, owes his own electoral fortunes to, you know, a sort of faction of Canada that is inclined to this kind of more sort of left-wing anti-American nationalist kind of sentiment. And he sort of has to sort of care and feed that faction. And I think that's why he perhaps does not quite feel the same movement to sort of resolve this situation. So again, like, as much as we can sort of say that this is a, that this is an era of sort of greater compatibility between the Biden administration and the Trudeau administration, because the two leaders are sort of more ideologically in tune, Trudeau still has to deal with this kind of nationalist sentiment within his country that sort of transcends all sort of partisan considerations, and instead sort of is rooted in a sort of deeper sense of Canadian identity, which is often, I think, like I said, you know, quite resistant to any sort of integration with the U.S., regardless of how rational it may be.
Since you talking about greater integration, you, like you said, you've been very outspoken about that. In one of your videos, you even reference a desire for a sort of union between the United States and Canada, referencing it as one of your great ambitions in life. And I know enough about Canada to know that that's probably a very unpopular opinion. Yes. In Canada. So could you talk about why you think that would be beneficial, and if that kind of integration is something that you think is ever realistic?
Well, I mean, I think that if you believe that that broadly speaking, Canada and the United States are sort of successful countries in the way that we're structured, right? Like, we're successful countries as federal societies that allow free movement of goods and people across, you know, within our respective borders, right? Like, it is, I think, relatively uncontroversial to assert that it is a good thing, say, that, you know, California can trade freely with Arizona or Oregon or, you know, New York on the other end of the country or whatever, or that, you know, Californians can be free to live and work in, you know, New York or Vermont or Texas or Idaho or wherever. Like, that, and vice versa in Canada. You know, as a British Columbian, I'm from Vancouver, you know, I can, and I have gone and lived in Toronto for a time and worked and lived there. And, you know, there was no bureaucratic hurdles. I was able to sort of pursue my rational economic self-interest and contribute to their economy for a time and so on. And that has been a great success, I think, for both of our countries, that we allow sort of freedom of trade and labor within our own borders. And so I think that there's no real rational reason to believe that those principles could not also be effectively applied for great success if we could do it across the 49th parallel, which is a completely arbitrary ruler line that has just been drawn for colonial reasons to separate our two countries. So I think that it's, you know, I consider myself to be a relatively anti-nationalist person, and I think that a lot of people on the progressive left consider themselves to be anti-nationalists. But in this country, progressives sort of seem to turn off that part of their brain when it comes to the U.S., right? Like, there's nobody that's sort of more nationalistic and more protectionistic when it comes to this issue than a lot of progressives in this country, because they are not sort of seeing it from, I think, a matter of rational self-interest. They're seeing it from a sort of nationalistic perspective, where the idea is that, you know, Canada and the U.S. are two countries that are founded in fundamental opposition to each other, and that sort of the purpose of the Canadian National Project is to maximize sovereignty from the United States. And I just kind of see that as an obstacle. I think that, you know, Canada, for instance, has been demonstrably bettered by having free trade with the United States. It was very contentious when it was first proposed in the 1980s. But when Trump and Trudeau renegotiated this new NAFTA 2.0, it passed the Canadian Parliament unanimously. That is how universally vindicated this idea has been. And I think that if we can say that that was a an idea that has withstood the test of time and has been vindicated in such a way. The Canadian standard of living is much better now. We have access to goods and services from America that we didn't have even when I was a child. And if that is an idea that has been vindicated by history, then why not begin pursuing the next step? And to me, the next step is to have even more free trade, and as well to have free movement of people and labor across the border as well, just as they do in the European Union, just as they do between Australia and New Zealand. It's a model that I think is self-evidently in the interest of both countries. And I think it is only, frankly, mostly sort of small-minded nationalistic opposition in Canada that's preventing it from happening.
Would you be concerned that the far more populous United States, I think Canada is smaller than California in population, would you be concerned that the far more populous United States kind of overshadow Canada in a way that the interests of Canada would be almost pushed to the side in favor of the much larger markets, the larger consumer base, and the much larger investment base in a sort of economic integration like you're talking about that's in the United States?
I mean, I guess that's a concern. I mean, in the same way that you could say that the Canadian economy right now is very much biased towards the interests of our two largest provinces, like Quebec and Ontario. And I mean, this is not an uncommon criticism, I think, that is made in the United States as well, is that a lot of sort of the market economy in the U.S. is very biased towards the large consumer markets in California and New York. And, you know, everything is concentrated in these two sort of economic powerhouse capitals, and that sort of leaves a lot of other regions of the country sort of economically disadvantaged as a result. And I mean, like, and that's fair. I mean, that's a fair criticism. This is a fair criticism even without contemplating the idea of an integrated North American continent. And I think that this is something that we are struggling with because, you know, in the age of Trump, right, like it suddenly became very fashionable to everybody to sort of affect great concern about the sort of the left behind regions of the United States, right? Like that in a sort of free, sort of neoliberal kind of economic model, that the benefits of free trade and, you know, outsourcing and sort of the race for maximum market efficiency has resulted in, you know, a prosperity that has not been evenly shared, you know, that the gains of this sort of new neoliberal order have been disproportionately concentrated in a few, you know, big cities and a few geographic corners of the country. And that's been the case in Canada just as much as it's been the case in the United States. And so I think that you raise a fair point, right, which is that if we were to have an economically integrated entire North American continent, would we just see those trends sort of continue? Right. Like it might not even necessarily be in the sense that sort of Canada as a collective is sort of disadvantaged, but, you know, just that, you know, it might be an integration that would be very good for the big city Canadians who are already doing very well. But, you know, the people that are being left behind in the current Canadian Federation would continue to be left behind in an even more ambitious federation, in the same way that the Americans that are being left behind in their current federation would be left behind in an integrated federation as well. I think it's a perfectly valid concern. It's just I don't necessarily believe that protectionism is the best answer to that question, that sort of having a more robust protectionist nationalist economy is necessarily the correct answer. I think the correct answer is to pursue integration, but also be aware of the existence of losers, you know, in a sort of not in a pejorative sense, but like that the idea that there would be sort of losers from an ambitious plan like that. And instead, any sort of plan for integration would have various sort of compensatory, mitigating, you know, policy proposals that would be explicitly intended to sort of offset some of that. And I'm not enough of a wonk to necessarily know what that would look like in practice, but I definitely do think it's something that we have to be very sensitive to, just because, like I sort of said, this is, I think, awareness of the inequalities that have been unleashed by a purely dogmatic sort of neoliberal free trade, free movement kind of style of politics is one we should take seriously.
A lot of what you've been talking about reminded me of something that I wanted to talk to you based on your latest columns in the Washington Post related to Quebec. And over the past, you know, decade or so, there's been an increase in French Canadian nationalism, and there's even more right-wing populist ideas and leaders, and that the Quebec premier
cut immigration and a lot of these nasty traits that we're seeing. And it reminds me of the increase in right-wing nationalism that we're seeing in many European countries and obviously here in the US. Mm-hmm. How do you think the rise in Trumpism has emboldened or fanned the flames for these ideas in Quebec? And
That's an interesting question. I never quite actually thought of it from that dimension. I mean, I think that the Quebecers would not really sort of see their current nationalism as being inspired by someone like Trump. Like maybe on some level it's emboldened just in the sense that I think that, you know, Trump suggested to a lot of politicians all over the world that, you know, like anything is possible and like, don't listen to the elites who say it can't be done, like push hard against the boundaries of the Overton window and, you know, really sort of go for your big dreams. But I definitely think that, you know, the Quebec nationalists of the sort that are embodied by the current sort of right-wing regime running the province are certainly inspired by the kind of right-wing nationalist populism that we see in Europe, right? And that sort of in the sense that, you know, you can put Trump and you can put like France's Le Pen and Holland's Geert Wilders and, you know, I don't know, the folks in Italy and in Germany and all the rest of it. To the extent you can sort of put them into one big column and sort of say that they're all sort of cross-pollinating each other, I think that's a sort of fair assertion to make. I mean, I definitely think that like if Quebec was already an independent country, as you know, a certain faction always dreams that it will be someday, I think that we would regard Quebec as being like one of the first countries we would cite when people like I just was are sort of prattling off the list of like the most infamous sort of right-wing populist regimes in the world. I think that Quebec under Prime Minister Legault would be seen as sort of one of the leading exemplars of that, just because that not only has he cut immigration, not only has he brought in, you know, prohibitions on the Muslim women wearing the headscarf and so on, you know, it's getting even sort of more comically extreme in terms of some of these like French only language policies that they're introducing. There was one in the news just the other day that said that his government has now introduced a policy that in government buildings, you are only to play French music, right? Like no more international music if you're at the Quebec DMV or whatever, because this is somehow seen as sort of eroding the national character, right? Like this stuff is so extreme and so preposterous that anywhere else it would sort of be seen as sort of self-evidently bigoted and prejudiced. But I think because it's sort of happening in the context of Canada, and because, you know, we, I think Americans in particular, but Canadians themselves and sort of the globe as a whole have this idea that Canada is this, you know, fundamentally sort of very progressive place. And thus, you know, the existence of a sort of like crazed nationalist government in the context of perfect progressive Canada, I think sort of scrambles people's brains in a bit and makes it sort of less discussed.
So you brought up what I was going to ask you about next, just to put our listeners into context. Quebec wants to declare itself like a separate nation, which reminds me of what's happening over here in the West Coast. I'm in Oregon, and I know that there's a lot of Oregonians that support Cal Exit or like the idea of like separating California and Oregon and maybe Washington State want to join. I don't know what that would be called, even though it's pretty improbable. How are those similar?
Well, it's actually I think worse in the Quebec case, because in the sense of like Cal Exit or I've heard it described as the Cascadia movement, you know, like the whole sort of West Coast, right? Like that is an idea that is motivated by a sort of assertion of a political interest, right? Like it's this idea that like we can govern ourselves and pursue our economic interests better if we are sort of organized in a different sort of political structure, right? Like that, you know, the United States, as it is currently constructed, like does not exist for like the economic self-determination or political self-determination of this geographic region, which is, of course, very diverse and so on and so forth. But what the Quebec government is doing right now, the Quebec government is pressing for a constitutional amendment to the Canadian Constitution, which it seems like is going to sail through. There's no significant political opposition to it. It passed nearly unanimously in the Canadian Parliament the other day. What they want is they want to declare themselves a nation of the French Canadian people, right? And so in this sort of sense, like we need to kind of make a fine kind of political science distinction between what is a nation versus like what is a country, right? Which is like, we tend to think of a country as sort of like, it's a political structure, right? Like it's a democratic, you know, parliament and all of that kind of thing. Like it's a sovereign entity. Whereas a nation, like to declare yourself a nation in this sense, and the way that it's sort of written in the proposed amendment is that, you know, the Quebecois people constitute a nation. Right. So it's and the Quebecois people are, of course, understood to sort of be like the French Canadian people as a sort of like racialized kind of homogenous ethnic group. Like we are a nation that is the and that French is the language of our nation. And through our nation, it is also the language of our state. And like the state is the state of Quebec, the province of Quebec. Right. And so to me, like that is, I think, a pretty blunt exertion of a kind of ethno-nationalism. Right. It's sort of saying that the province of Quebec is not a sort of diverse multi-ethnic democracy the way that all the other provinces of Canada are. It's like Quebec's identity first and foremost is as the housing of a nation, the nation of these very particular sorts of people, and that the nation state, such as it is, of Quebec, should reflect sort of the cultural priorities of those people that are sort of prioritized above all others. And thus, that's why, you know, you can have the Legault administration is also sort of demanding that French be the only official language, the only language that people have a right to government services from, and, you know, all of this other kind of stuff. You know, cutting immigration is also sort of inspired by that as well, in a way that sort of like, I don't even think Trump in his worst days, maybe he would be sometimes, but like to sort of assert quite so brazenly that we're cutting immigration because we want to maintain the ethnic linguistic balance of our province, and that we view these kinds of things as being, you know, sort of dangerous to our ability to sort of maintain this national identity, to maintain the integrity of the national, the Quebec nation, the nation of the Quebecois people, right? So that's I think a distinction that we have to be very, very clear about understanding, because it is an incredibly exclusionary definition that really, I think, I don't know, like, I don't know where this is going in the long term, but there's no reason to believe that it means that Quebec is going to become more integrated into this idea that Quebec, or that Canada supposedly stands for, which is this idea of a multi-ethnic, diverse, tolerant, pluralistic, multicultural, democratic society.
You made a great parallel in your article to what Marjorie Taylor Greene authored and then kind of backtracked on the Anglo-Saxon nation or whatever that
the caucus. Yeah, like the Anglo-Saxon caucus or whatever. Yeah, where it's like
lasted a weekend. I think that idea. Yeah. And then I didn't read it. I didn't write it. No, I was just, you know.
I mean, I don't want to play this sort of game where it's sort of like, well, what if and what about and all that kind of stuff, because I mean, but it is worth noting, right? Like it is, do we have different standards for different types of nationalisms, right? Like if the Quebecers would say, the French Canadians would say that this is the nationalism of a historically aggrieved minority, which is fair, you know, like the French Canadian people were a aggrieved minority, like in the time of my grandmother or my grandparents, for instance. Like I remember the way that they would speak about French Canadian people as this kind of underclass and, you know, the ones that were the janitors and all this kind of thing. But the idea now is that the French Canadians do have very firm control of this one province. And the idea, if their historic grievances with the English Canadian majority really justify the sort of tactics that they're employing now. I mean, I think this is a difficult question for some people to answer, because it gets into this question of sort of like, do we have a kind of universal standard that we can bluntly apply across the border over who gets to be a country, who gets to be a nation, to what degree is it okay to have a sort of ethno-nationalistic kind of conception of what your country is for? You know, this is a debate, you know, I've brought up analogies to the rising nationalism of indigenous peoples in this country as well, right? We could also think of the nationalism of say in Israel, right? Like the kind of Zionist nationalism, right? Like there's many different sort of flavors of nationalism, and it is sometimes difficult to, I think, impose a one-size-fits-all standard of who gets to be a nation, who gets to have a nation state that honors that particular and exclusive concept of nationalism. And I think because the French Canadians are a historically aggrieved minority within Canada, that's why progressive-minded people like Prime Minister Trudeau, like the New Democratic Party under Jagmeet Singh, could say that they support that kind of nationalism, because to them, they wouldn't sort of see it as something that's bigoted or exclusionary. They would see it as sort of being more akin to, say, like the nationalism of the indigenous Canadians, as opposed to a kind of, you know, right-wing nationalism of someone like Trump or the Europeans.
Quebec makes up a significant portion of the base of a lot of left-wing politics in Canada, the Liberal Party and such. And when it does come to things like banning burqas and hijabs and such, how is that squared with the progressive priorities of the parties that have to maintain the good graces in Quebec?
That's a very good question. I really don't know how they square that particular circle. It just really sort of seems to me that they just don't talk about it that much or think about it that much, or you know, if they're like, you know, if the reporters stick the microphones in their face and say, you know, Mr. Prime Minister or Mr. Opposition Leader or whatever, like, what is your opinion on this, is they'll just kind of mumble and they'll say, well, you know, personally I disagree with it, but you know, I support provincial autonomy, and you know, they'll say things like, I will continue to speak out against this policy when I think it's wrong. But then you're like, of course they never will, because it's very low on their priority scale. So it is, I mean, it's a tremendous hypocrisy on the Canadian left. And I think that it sort of speaks volumes that the Canadian left does not talk more about it, right? It's a very curious sort of thing that really has no analogy in American politics, right, where you have a sort of progressive political faction that is in a sort of electoral alliance with a very sort of regressive faction of the society. And it's because, in part as well, that Quebecers have a kind of more uniquely, I think you could sort of say, like, European understanding of politics, which is where they can be very right wing on social issues, but then very left wing on economic issues and issues relating to, you know, government sort of welfare state type of things, you know, the public health care system and the environment as well, is worth noting. Premier Legault's government, for all of its sort of right wing bona fides on social issues, is very progressive on stuff like climate change, very dogmatically opposed to the oil and natural gas industry, particularly as it relates to his province. So there's a dimension to the problem where, you know, the left wingers, the progressives, don't want to alienate Quebec voters too much, because they're necessary not only to just kind of get elected in some sort of cynical way, but they'd be seen as sort of like important allies to have in some of these larger sort of fights and these sort of larger coalitions that you want to be able to assemble in politics in order to get sort of significant movement on things like climate change done. So as much as it's sort of easy for me to judge, you can understand as well that some of this is just sort of politics as a kind of cynical game, and that you just kind of often do have to form alliances. I suppose in some ways you could almost kind of think of it as sort of being akin to like foreign policy, right? Where it's like we make alliances all the time with international countries with whom we might not agree with on a whole number of levels for domestic reasons, or sort of their internal politics are very at odds with our own. But we still realize that we sort of need them as allies to fight for some larger good. And so that requires turning a bit of a blind eye. But overall, I do agree that it is largely a hypocrisy that I think the Canadian left has mostly avoided trying to grapple with in a sort of substantial way.
So the point of this episode was, you've talked before, you and I have talked before, and you even referenced earlier that a lot of times Americans don't know very much about Canadian politics, even though it's one of our most important partnerships in the world. And so we're hoping to give people a little bit of an introductory course on that. So in parting, if you could give one thing for American listeners that may not know much about your country's politics, what's the most important thing that they should know about Canada?
Oh, man. I mean, I think that certainly as it relates to politics, I think that, you know, as much as Canada gets a sort of very glowing sort of progressive reputation for certain things, you know, certainly for the public health care system and for, you know, say like gun control and things like that, they're very much sort of seem very out of reach dreams for progressives in the United States. I do think it's also important for Americans to realize that there have been trade-offs along the way in Canadian politics in order to achieve some of those goals. And I do think that one of the quite substantial trade-offs is that the Canadian political system is significantly less democratic than the American political system is. And I think that's something that a lot of progressives in the United States are not really sort of prepared to hear, but it is true. You know, Canadians cannot elect their own candidates for public office the way that Americans can. You know, nominees for everything from prime minister to just member of parliament are not trusted to Canadian people. You know, it's the party establishment decides who your candidates will be, and you can sort of take it or leave it. So there is nothing equivalent to primaries in Canada in that sort of sense, a mass democratic exercise to sort of select candidates for high office. That's just not part of it. And as well, like, there is not free voting, you know, this is actually a term we use in Canada, like a free vote in the parliament is very rare, right? Parliament, or the political parties in Canada, are very tightly, as Americans would say, whipped, you know, in the sense that they're very dependent on what the leaders want, and what the leaders want generally passes with, you know, not much sort of substantial debate or negotiation. It's not like in the United States, you know, we have all this drama about, like, well, can we get Joe Manchin on board and all of this kind of thing, right? In Canada, like, it's just done. Like, it's a fait accompli, right? Like, when I talk about that controversial constitutional amendment, or even say something like the free trade agreement we were talking about before, like, a lot of this stuff just kind of gets blasted through with these unanimous votes and very little discussion, because the party leaders, in this very hierarchical sort of way, you know, they get together and they just kind of say, like, well, this is what we should have, and, you know, and that's efficient, right? Like, that can result in very sort of sweeping legislation that I think Americans who sometimes look at the deadlock in Washington, D.C. might envy, and they'd say, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just get that kind of sort of swift action taken? But at the same time, like, that does require a trade-off. It means that there is in many ways sort of less control for an individual Canadian to sort of exercise over his political representatives than Americans have. And it's just, there's sacrifices that have to be made, I guess it's just what I would say.
Well, do you have anything you want to plug before we finish up, JJ?
I guess just check out my YouTube channel. I'm doing pretty well on YouTube these days, recently passed 300,000 subs. I make videos every week. Every Saturday, often about Canada, sometimes about politics, but on a diverse array of topics relating to sort of culture and civics more broadly. So I'd encourage everyone to check it out.
With great animations and sound effects.
Thank you. Yeah, I try too hard to do good sound effects. It's one of my big passions.
Do you do those drawings, by the way? The illustrations
yeah,
you
usually.
Sometimes have?
Yeah, usually if there's cartoons in my video, I've usually drawn them myself, yeah.
Very cool.
They're very cool.
Oh, thank you.
You have two fans right here.
Delightful.
Well, thank you for coming on today, JJ.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
So I enjoyed that a lot, Sylvia. And one of the reasons I like to hear from JJ, I think, is because I was able to give you, like, you know, I was able to give you facts and, like, here's what people have said. And JJ is able to give us a lot more analysis than I think I would be able to as an American who's hasn't been to Canada yet, although I'm hoping to get up there soon. My wife has a visa that we're hoping to use before it expires once COVID's over. I thought it was really interesting, especially what he said at the end there about the Canadian government system being less democratic. And I had never heard that kind of analysis about party whipping and, like, the way that there's no primaries and such like that before he said there.
I agree with you. That was super interesting. Also, because during your explanation, you talked about how Canadians usually know more about US politics and not about Canadian politics. And maybe it's because they don't get as involved. They don't have to, or maybe they don't feel like they have to get as involved with politics because they don't get to vote in things like primaries and selecting the individual people and their prime minister.
Yeah, I would imagine whether you're Canadian or British, like, that must feel weird to not really get to, you know, like, even have a choice in who your head of government is when your country says that it's a democracy. And, like, I'm not saying Canada's not a democracy, because it is, but that just must be a weird feeling to live in a system that elects your leader that way. And also, it's another perspective on the nature of something being undemocratic, because we talk a lot about America's undemocraticness in, you know, the way that the wealthy have a disproportionate influence on politics, which I think is a similar issue in Canada, but also things like the Electoral College and voter suppression and stuff. And it was interesting to hear him bring up another perspective of how you can not necessarily have problems with things like the Electoral College, but still have a less democratic system than you could. And I know JJ is a small R Republican in the sense that he doesn't think Canada should be a monarchy. He doesn't think that Queen Elizabeth should be the head of state of Canada. And we didn't ask him this, but I wonder if he would want to have a president of Canada that has a national election rather than a prime minister. If you guys want to hear more, I think you should definitely go and subscribe to his channel. It's JJ McCullough on YouTube, and there's a lot of interesting stuff on there. And hear him talk about the monarchy, hear him talk about Quebec, hear him talk about the left-wing nationalism in Canada, and all kinds of issues not even related to Canada sometimes. If you guys enjoyed the show, definitely be sure to give it a rating and a review. If you're on a platform that allows for that, share it with a friend, a coworker, an enemy, a family member. The number one way podcast grows through word of mouth. And definitely subscribe so that you don't miss an episode.
Yeah, remember to follow us at The Explanation Pod on Instagram, at @TheExplanation_pod on Twitter, and just search for The Explanation Podcast on Facebook.
Next week, Sylvie and I are going to be talking about voter suppression, some of the bills that have been being passed in states recently, things like H.R. 1 and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and why this is a problem, how to overcome it. And we're going to be talking to Rachel Paula, who is the former president of the Young Democrats of Georgia. And she's now, don't have it written down in front of me, but she has another statewide position as an activist in Georgia. And she's very well educated on that. You know that Georgia is one of the front lines of voter suppression in the United States. So I'm very excited for that.
This is one of my favorite topics, so I can't wait.
Definitely be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss that. And if you have any feedback, questions, comments, or concerns, then definitely send us an email at info@explanationpod.com. Thank you for joining us, and happy Canada Day.
Bye.